Is it just me, or does it seem as though policymakers seeking answers to the energy crisis are sounding a lot like this?
You want answers? I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Question, can policymakers in Washington handle the emerging truths about the volatile world oil market? Where will oil prices be when the shouting stops? It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, June 10th, and we have lots of truth to handle about our energy and food prices today. We take a tour of the world to see what it costs to fill up your tank. A supercomputer graduates. Can you say petaflops?
Petaflops.
And there's tension brewing over U.S. beef in South Korea. That and all the news. President Bush is hoping to get a lot done on his last year visit. Today he's meeting with EU leaders in Slovenia to discuss Zimbabwe, climate change, trade, and energy. The leaders are expected to issue a joint statement warning Iran of more sanctions if it does not abandon its uranium enrichment plans. Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke says the risk of a major downturn has faded. Addressing a Fed conference last night, he said progress repairing the financial and credit markets, plus the economic stimulus package and strong U.S. exports should help avoid a substantial downturn.
The U.S. Senate can't handle the truth. It votes today on whether to levy a windfall profits tax against the five largest U.S. oil companies and to rescind $17 billion in tax breaks the companies expect to enjoy over the next decade. Republicans have vowed to oppose any new taxes on the oil industry. Floodwaters are rising in the Midwest from weekend rains, threatening dams in a number of states. Part of a man-made lake gave way in Wisconsin, destroying five homes. Elsewhere in the state, an entire village was evacuated because of flooding. In the east, there's a sweltering heat wave from Georgia to New England. A New Yorker named Lauren says it's hard to find anyone who's happy with the weather.
You don't like the hot, you don't like the cold. You're never happy, right?
A cold front moving into the northeast tonight should bring some relief for the heat.
Eight suspected members of an Islamic extremist cell are under arrest in Spain. The suspects are said to be Algerian and are accused of recruiting people, raising money, and providing logistical support for terror groups linked to Al-Qaeda. McDonald's, Walmart, and other U.S. chains have halted sales of some raw tomatoes after a salmonella food poisoning outbreak hit several states. In the last 2 months, 145 people have been infected with the same type of food poisoning.
Asian stock markets are down steeply today. China's Shanghai Index fell 7.7%. The Dow futures are pointing for a lower close. The Dow begins the day at 12,280. The S&P begins at 1361. We are asking the question, if you grow your own food or buy locally or do local agricultural kinds of things as a way to reduce your energy consumption, reduce costs, what sort of stories do you have of being successful at that or failing at that? We want to hear your stories at 877-MY-TAKE. Local vores, they're called. We're going to have more about that in a minute.
Or if you make your own clothes, how much time did it take? Was it efficient? Did you save some money?
Was it a fiasco? We want to know. 877-8-MY-TAKE. Also, security cameras. Love them or hate them, they're there. What's your creepiest story of a security camera watching you on The Takeaway?
Nice sound effect, John.
Yes, it's free, too.
Thank you.
Comes right out of my head.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. That's right. Who can handle the truth of these oil prices? They're at about $135 a barrel in Asian trading today. It's down about $4, but still very high, and the market is as volatile as ever. Who can handle the truth of energy prices in this economy? Well, a former oil man by the name of George W. Bush.
We'll remind our friends and allies overseas that we're all too dependent on hydrocarbons. We must work to advance technologies to help us become less dependent on hydrocarbons.
Yes, the 21st century reality of energy prices is typified by that statement from our president, George W. Bush, leaving before going off to a European trip. A former Texas oil man talking about our addiction to hydrocarbons. In the 21st century, being dependent on hydrocarbons and being realistic about it is a major global policy issue. President Bush is in Slovenia talking about energy prices and a lot of other issues. There's also an international meeting in Saudi Arabia to talk about oil producing and consuming nations and the price of oil and its effect on the global economy. And there are demonstrations all over Europe about the high cost of fuel. Joining us now to talk about the persistent high price of energy and its cultural effect and whether it's actually sinking in is Lisa Marganelli, our friend, who's the author of Oil on the Brain, Petroleum's Long, Strange Trip to Your Tank. And it's been longer and stranger than ever these days. Lisa, hello. Thanks for joining us.
Hello.
You know, prices are high. We've talked about that before. But it seems as though if you look around the world and listen to former oil men like our president talk, culturally, the world is getting used to a fundamentally different reality about energy. Is that how you see it?
Yes. I don't know that we're necessarily used to it. But, yeah, we're starting to talk like it's a different reality. And that comes that brings with it a whole bunch of sort of political theater as well. You know, we have Congress gearing up to sue OPEC and things like that. But this this isn't a small problem, and it hasn't happened overnight. I mean, prices have been going up dramatically for the past 6 years.
Well, let's talk for a moment about policy responses. I mean, if culturally people are beginning to accept the reality of high energy prices, we don't necessarily have a great track record in the United States in coming up with levers to actually deal with it, besides task forces and windfall profits taxes and strategic energy reserves. There really aren't a lot of levers to pull. What do you think Congress might try that would be new this time around?
Well, they're going to try things like windfall profit taxes. I think in the late 70s and early 80s, we actually tried a whole bunch of different levers, including massive energy conservation and really changing some foreign policy procedures that foreign policies that we probably couldn't do again. We need that kind of massive relook at what we're doing and a whole new set of tools to kind of influence oil prices. But what's going to happen right now in the short term is that the politicians are going to try to do things that will have sort of running up to the election, it's going to have a 5-month timetable, but overall it's going to have a 4-year timetable. And the thing about energy policies is you need 10 or 20 years to get something really going.
10 or 20 years. But speaking of solutions, Lisa, mm-hmm. What's interesting is that it seems like there are so many differing opinions as to why these oil prices are so high. And if that's the case, how do you fashion a solution?
Well, you can either talk just about the problems or you can talk about where we need to be, which is, you know, funnily enough, exactly what the president is saying, is that we need to really rethink our relationship to hydrocarbons in general. We have a greenhouse gas problem that is, while it's not as acute as the prices at the pump, it's pretty extreme, and if we really think it through, we'll realize that in some ways these high prices, I would hesitate to call them a blessing, but, you know, there are warning signs that we really have to do something.
Well, Lisa, you know, one of the things I am hearing that does sound kind of new is an attempt to regulate the market at the sort of investment level to try to control the amount of speculation in the market. People who are trading oil who have no business trading oil, at least as far as the energy economy is concerned. Is there a way to do that, to keep investment banks out of the market?
Well, I think we should ask whether we actually want that. I mean, the market is based on the idea that anybody can come in and trade in oil. It's not a secret trading. It's not secret. During the early 70s, it was completely secret. All the deals were made in back rooms. Nobody could do it except for the oil companies and the oil producers. And now the idea is that everybody all around the world can trade oil madly, and this sort of real oil price gets revealed through the market. Obviously, the real oil price that's getting revealed right now is so insanely high that, you know, we're freaking out. And so people want to go in and control the market, which they've depended upon, to set prices for years and years. I'm not sure that legislators are great people to go around and mess around in delicate things like the market, but it's definitely a worthwhile discussion to have and to really think about whether or not the rest of the government or the rest of us are really responding to the market in the way that we should be.
Well, it's interesting that this is a new part of the debate, and certainly people are going to be learning a lot more about the mechanism of how the oil price is set. Lisa Marganelli, thanks for joining us, author of Oil on the Brain, Petroleum's Long Strange Trip to Your Tank. Thanks, Lisa.
Thanks.
Today, South Korea's President Lee Mong-bak's newly installed administration, well, it's hanging on by a thread following violent protests on Sunday involving thousands outraged over the proposal to overturn a five-year ban on imported U.S. beef. For weeks, South Koreans have been marching, motivated by fears of tainted American beef, potentially carrying mad cow disease. Opposition politicians are threatening to boycott parliament, and several members of the ruling party have offered their resignation today. Also expected today is another protest, which could draw as many as 1 million people.
All over U.S. beef?
All over U.S. beef.
Like hamburgers?
Like hamburgers.
Like ribs and...
16 pounds... for each South Korean a year. That's how much they eat of beef. Joining us from Seoul is the BBC's John Sudworth. And good morning, John. Thanks for joining us, or I should say good evening there. The World Organization for Animal Health has certified that U.S. beef providers, their standards are sufficient to control the risk of mad cow disease. The Korean public, well, they're not buying it, are they?
No, they're not. They do eat a lot of beef here, it's true, and they also pay some of the highest prices in the world for their beef. And that's one of the arguments that's being made, that if they did open the market to US beef once again, prices would fall. So you have the very odd position of tens of thousands of people out on the streets. I've just come back, actually, from the demonstration taking place right in front of our office, and the organisers are saying this will be one of the biggest ones yet. They're predicting 1 million people nationwide out on the streets today. And essentially, critics of what's going on will say these people are essentially demonstrating in favour of continuing to pay high prices for beef. But you're right, the World Organization for Animal Health, that's an intergovernmental body that does the science and decides whether or not various agricultural products are fit for exports, has deemed that the US does have the necessary safeguards. So there is something else going on, and some people have speculated that it is a little bit more political than first meets the eye.
Well, John, and what are some of those issues, John?
Well, on face value, if you speak to the protesters, they do say this is about food safety. In particular, they focus on imports of beef from US cattle aged over 30 months, which they say will expose the country to an unacceptable risk of mad cow disease. In fact, there have been rumours here widely circulated on the internet and amongst the protesters themselves that Americans don't eat beef from cattle aged over 30 months. All the evidence shows that that's complete nonsense. Americans eat large quantities of beef from older cattle, considered perfectly safe. So it is something else. And some people have said that this is really an issue about the timing and the political management. Don't forget that politicians in Washington were threatening to scupper the free trade agreement between the US and South Korea unless this ban on US beef was lifted. The new president, very keen to get this FTA, this free trade agreement through, duly obliged, lifted the beef ban. And I think people feel that perhaps it's been done without enough regard to the sensitivities of the issue, that it's been done for something more political. And I think that's what's angered a lot of people.
Is it nationalism, though? Because there's something a little bit counterintuitive about millions of people in the streets at this point in history protesting and insisting on paying higher prices for food. That's exactly what's going on here.
Well, it is remarkable, especially when you think just a few miles away across the North Korean border, we're told that the country there is on the brink of famine. Some people are saying that there is a political edge to this, that it may be about the opposition that lost the last election. Don't forget, Lee Myung-bak was swept into power, essentially trouncing the liberal opposition.
And he was certainly very, very popular. Just very quickly, John, do you think he's going to survive? You have his prime minister offering to resign and others. Just a few seconds here.
Yeah, I think his survival is assured. This is a crisis, but one that people think with the right amount of reshuffling and political expertise can be got through.
The BBC's John Sudworth reporting from Seoul, South Korea. Thank you. Now time
now,
for a
now
break.
Time, now time
for a break.
A break.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253. Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Well, you're not just listening to The Takeaway. Hopefully you're calling 877-8-MY-TAKE to talk about what we have asked you to respond to today or anything on the show. But, you know, Femi Okeh was just doing that story with Ian Williams from the Centers for Disease Control. Ian Williams' suggestion on the salmonella outbreak for tomatoes is if you don't know where your tomatoes came from, discard them. Well, who knows where their tomatoes came from? It's not like the tomatoes are like showing you their exactly. It's not like the tomatoes are showing you their air itinerary. If it, we want to know is if you buy your food locally, if you've taken steps to avoid large-scale agriculture, tell us the story at 877-8-MY-TAKE, and we're going to talk about it in a minute. Because in the studio is Stephen Dubner, author of the book Freakonomics, and he writes the Freakonomics blog for the New York Times. Stephen, you've actually been investigating the impulse in these high-energy and high food price times to do it yourself, to get off the grid, to grow it yourself, make it yourself, and you've come up with some hard, cold, reality-based conclusions.
Well, investigating is a generous word for what I've been doing, but I've poked around a little bit, right? So it's a complex problem, which is part of the issue here, right? The minute we talk about, you know, food miles, the difference between how much food has to travel and to account for all the carbon that goes into a grape that you eat coming from Chile versus a grape that your neighbor grew, you know, the math gets to be pretty complicated. So we have to, but people smarter than I have actually done that. They've looked at the food miles associated with the food that Americans typically eat, and here's what
they found.
Testing
the proposition of grow locally is better, right? Or right. Buy locally
you,
is better.
You would think so, yeah. Right? You would think, gosh, it's got to be. If I can buy all my food. Well, the problem right. is, so first of all, you can't buy all your food, right? Second of all, there's such a thing that we all know in theory, but we try to ignore it in practice, which is efficiency, right? We want to do what we want to do because we like to do what we like to do. So if I want to have a garden, I don't care that it might be inefficient. But the fact is, if 100 people have a garden, it starts to be 100 little inefficiencies. Whereas the grocery store is kind of the end product of a couple centuries worth of food production efficiency research. In other words, the food that's coming from around the world to the grocery store ends up having probably a smaller carbon footprint than 100 people growing locally. Okay.
Now, where does the carbon footprint come from for all the little gardens?
All right. Think about.
And you want some lettuce? I brought some.
No,
from
thank
my
you.
Garden.
It looks good though.
Oh, it's delicious.
Good and crunchy there.
Come on, you gotta have some.
He brags about his lettuce on a regular basis. Yeah. From what I've learned, this past weekend they enjoyed many, many fresh salads with his lettuce,
you know,
and it sounds so reasonable.
It sounds reasonable
to grow my own garden. You know, my father does it. We all know many people who like the idea of it. And it sounds reasonable that it would be cheaper and better for you.
If you like to eat nothing but lettuce, it's a fantastic proposition, for instance, right?
So tomatoes get a little dicey?
No, tomatoes are okay. Look, here's the point. Let's say I grew up on a farm. I grew up on a self-sufficiency farm, we
really?
Call it. Yeah, I was the youngest of 8 children, upstate New York. The soil was not particularly good. My parents were really working
Amish?
Hard. No, not Amish. They were Catholic converts from Judaism, so they had a whole religious reason to want to get back to the land. It was like a Catholic kibbutz kind of movement they had going. And I know how hard it is and how wonderful it is to grow all your own food. But here's the thing. Let's say you decide to plant a big garden to grow most of what you need, right?
Okay.
What you need to start to factor in is what you need to buy, where it's coming from, how many trips you're starting to make, the resources that you're putting into it, the number of people who are putting resources into it, and then the way you fill in around the foods that you're growing with other foods that you bought. So if you're really good, yeah, you can lessen your individual carbon footprint. The fact of the point, though, is that the locavore movement, which seems to be a wonderful idea, the food should taste better, like John is crunching on his lettuce there. The food should be more nutritious, right, in all theory.
Right.
The food should be cheaper, and it should be better for the environment. The delicious, I'm going to let you judge. The way you're munching on the lettuce, it sounds like it must be really good. The nutritious,
well, you can have some.
The nutritious is probably pretty good. Here's the problem with nutrition. What's good about a diet is balance, right? If you can grow everything that you need, but I don't know if I'm going to grow my wheat germ and my lettuce and my fish, right? But so you have to fill in.
But can you barter and still reduce your carbon footprint And is there an aesthetic argument? In other words, if it feels good, is it okay, even if it might be a little irrational?
Is it just about the carbon imprint? I mean, it's also about me saving money. I mean, I like your example about making ice cream at home, right? You said it sounded like a really great idea, you and your kids, but it took a long time. It didn't taste that great, and it turned out to be far more expensive.
Yeah, it cost about four times what it would cost to go buy ice cream. Right. If it feels good, do it is a fantastic argument, and I would not argue that out of – I would not try to argue anybody out of that unless there's a movement that tells people you're not doing it because it feels good. You're not doing it just because it tastes good and it might be better for you. You're doing it, damn it, because you got to save the environment. And I'm saying this is not a way to save the environment, okay? It's a very nice idea. It appeals to the aesthetic and philosophical sense to us, but there's a really strong argument to be made that efficiencies that are created in this big capitalism that a lot of people find ugly are wonderful, those efficiencies.
But don't those efficiencies also produce mega, mega agriculture, agribusiness, processed foods, you know, a lot of products that maybe don't help us or the environment?
Sure, so don't buy them. We live in New York City. I go to my average grocery store, not the Fairway, not the Whole Foods.
You're talking fancy stores.
Let's say I go to the average one, the variety I get in that store. If I don't want to buy the agribusiness, I don't have to. You know, that's what efficiency produces, is variety at low cost.
All right, all you locavores, we want to hear from you then. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. What do you think about Stephen's idea of choice and getting off the grid? You can call us. Stephen's going to stick around. I'm going to eat my lettuce. And we're going to get some headlines from Femi Okay.
28 minutes past the hour. Oil is trading at around $135 a barrel in Asia today and is expected to go higher. The Senate votes on a windfall profits tax for the big US oil companies, and Ken Griffey Jr. is a brand new member of the 600 Home Run Club. United Nations experts headed to Myanmar's cyclone-hit region are getting help and cooperation from the military junta. 250 experts from the United Nations, including members of the Myanmar government, are going to the Irrawaddy Delta for a village-by-village assessment. The teams will be trying to work out what people need for food, water, and shelter. Saudi Arabia, the world's largest exporter of oil, is pledging to hold a summit to discuss soaring energy prices. The meeting would be a gathering of oil-producing nations and consumer states. The kingdom's information and culture minister is also pledging to work out with OPEC to, and I quote, guarantee the availability of oil supplies now and in the future, end of quote. And finally, customers who paid full price for their original iPhone may not be too pleased to hear about the second-generation iPhone. The all-in-one cell phone, iPod and web browser is out in July. And the biggest surprise about the new phone is actually the price tag. Here's Apple boss Steve Jobs.
And I'm really happy to tell you that the iPhone 3G is going to sell for $199.
Yeah, that's the low price one. There's also a $300 one, and they don't even tell you how much the AT&T contract is going to cost.
Well, the contract is going to be more expensive.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And it comes out in July.
You can't handle the truth.
Exactly right.
Why is it more expensive? It's going to be offering the same services, right?
Yeah.
It's new. It's sleeker. It has faster internet access. Not that I've looked.
Because they can.
It's my birthday, June the 30th. Thought I might mention it in the same segue as the iPhone.
Sure. Thank you, Femi. Okay.
Oh, you're welcome.
Great.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, now featuring Father's Day, a short film about a woman whose father left her when she was a child, and her daughter, who now wants to meet her estranged grandfather, if he lives long enough. Available at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Hi, my name is Brian Sharp from Brewster, Massachusetts. If someone's at the store and making a decision, wouldn't it be smarter to buy spring water that's produced two states away as opposed to spring water from Fiji? Just a thought. Just wanted to add that in. All right, thanks a lot.
Well, there's one answer from Brian to the question we've been asking, which is it cheaper? Is it better for the environment if you buy products that are made closer to you as opposed to ones that are shipped from, I don't know, another continent?
Take that, you Stephen Dubner.
Stephen Dubner, Freakonomics author, is still with us here in the studio. And we're talking about efficiencies. And we thought we would add to that mix of conversation the airline
industry. Yeah, they're so efficient.
Out of the clear blue of the western sky comes Sky King.
The sounds of a Cessna T-50, the sounds of a small plane, perhaps sounds of a better time. The big airlines are hiking fares, axing thousands of jobs, retiring dozens of fuel-inefficient planes, and continuing to cut what few amenities are left, John.
There are no amenities left.
The big airlines, they're streamlining, exactly, not much. But what about the smaller airlines? Joining us now is Dan Wolf, founder, CEO, and a pilot for Cape Air based on Cape Cod in Massachusetts. And Dan, I understand the skyrocketing fuel prices, you're not taking a huge hit on them.
Well, we're taking a hit just like everybody, but probably the impact on our company, Cape Air, is less than on the big airlines.
What makes your business model different, and why would that be the case?
Well, we're a lot of niche carriers out there. We probably redefine the term niche. So we serve very small communities, mostly short haul, so that fuel is a smaller percentage of our operating costs. So the impact of fuel changes are less on us than the big guys.
You run the largest independent regional airline in the country. You carry about 700,000 passengers a year, or you did so last year. Are you expanding this year?
Yeah, well, volatility creates opportunity. So for the small players like us, a lot of small communities around the country that had service from small jets and turboprop airplanes, those routes are becoming unviable for the equipment that are serving them, so that creates an opportunity for us. Call us a bottom feeder if you want.
A bottom feeder.
You know, one of the statistics in the airline industry that's always interesting is at what point, at what passenger point on the individual plane, the ride itself becomes profitable. I mean, I've seen numbers all over the map for big airlines, but for you, and I gather your planes carry about 9 people or maybe a few more. At what point do you have to fill those planes so that they're profitable?
Well, our break-even load factor is about 55%. And with the majors, as you know, it's up near 90%.
Wow.
And what kind of fare increases? What are your fares looking like today as opposed to last year?
It's very route-specific, but we're up probably on average between 10 and 15%. We like the majors, have done fare fuel surcharges on some of our markets. They vary anywhere from $5 to $10 one way.
And what are you anticipating for the rest of the season? Because obviously this is a high season for you, summer, because you don't necessarily rely so much on business travel as you do on leisure travel, right?
Yeah, and we are tracking the volatility of fuel prices. As they go up, we have to pass it along in our fares. Mm-hmm. And we have to be careful, because if we don't make hay while the sun shines by the end of the summer, the gate comes down and we have a long winter ahead of us. So we're staying right on top of it.
Dan, why does your approach not scale up?
In what sense?
In the sense that it can't be imitated by United or American or one of the bigger airlines.
I don't really think they take us seriously, actually. I don't blame them for that. But we sort of like to be the Rodney Dangerfield of the little airline world.
I've got a question for you, Dan. When American recently decided to charge $15 for the first bag, instead of adding it on to the price of the ticket, everybody hated them instantly. Why do you add surcharges? Why do you call it a surcharge and just instead of folding it into the price of a ticket?
Well, we don't do that, and I think you could have a long debate about whether it makes sense. We are very much about value added. So if we're going to add extra price onto the ticket for amenities that we provide, we have to make sure that they actually add value to it.
So the Rodney Dangerfield, that's your model. I guess, you know, that's a very hopeless message for the large carriers, because they're not going to ever have the efficiencies that you have. And at the scale that the big airlines have to operate at to cover the country, it's really hard to see how they would ever make a profit.
Well, the issue is really the demand and the capacity. And the problem is the airline industry is hopeless in that every time we start to get healthy, we create just enough capacity so that we become unprofitable. And I guess the question is, what's going to break that cycle?
And Dan, you just said that you don't think the major carriers take you seriously. Perhaps they should.
Well, I was being a little bit tongue-in-cheek, actually. We partner with all of the major airlines. Our real challenge at Cape Air is to connect small communities into the national and international air transportation system. So our best partners are the major airlines. We partner with all of them. So that, you know, when I say they don't take us seriously, they're not really interested in our niche of the world. Because of the equipment they operate, they're really focused on long-haul markets. And in many cases, those markets are just too competitive. There's too much capacity on them.
Dan Wolf, CEO of Cape Air, based in Massachusetts. Thank you. And Stephen J. Dubner, journalist and author of the book Freakonomics, as well as the blog Freakonomics for the New York Times.
We have an economic update. The Shanghai market in China is down 7.7% this morning, and the Dow futures are way down. We expect a down open on Wall Street, and more economic news from Femi Oke.
Yeah, just picking up where you left off, John, the figures from the Commerce Department just come out in the last couple of minutes. The trade deficit jumped to the highest level in 13 months in April as America's bill for foreign crude oil soared to an all-time high. So the gap between what the nation imports and what it sells abroad rose by 7.8%. That's up to $60.9 billion, and that's the largest imbalance since March 2007. In other international and national news headlines that I'm following, the Midwest struggles to shore up a rising rivers, while the East wilts under soaring temperatures. President Bush meets with the European leaders in Slovenia. The Bush administration admits for the first time that a joint security agreement with Iraq may not be settled until the next president takes office. In Ukraine, rescue workers are racing against time to reach 12 miners still trapped underground after a gas explosion at a coal mine on Sunday. Now, earlier this morning, I spoke to the BBC's Gabriel Gatehouse in Kiev for an update on the 12 missing miners.
Three of them are probably buried under rubble. Nine, we understand, were up on their way up through the shaft in the lift when the explosion happened. We understand that they got as far as 200 metres from the ground level when the explosion happened and then plunged back down to the bottom.
That was the BBC's Gabriel Gatehouse reporting there from Kiev in Ukraine. 24 miners were rescued following the explosion, and the body of one miner was also recovered. And finally, a top Somali Islamist leader has rejected a UN-brokered three-month ceasefire deal signed by Somalia's government and an opposition bloc. Sheikh Hassan Dahir Awaz says he will continue fighting until all foreign troops leave the country. Ethiopian troops have backed Somalia's army in the fight against the Islamists. Let's look at some of the news that we've been following this morning.
In just a few seconds you've been in here, Femi, the Dow Industrial Futures are reacting to the trade deficit figures positively, as often happens, even though it was a down number on the trade deficit. The stock market is reacting marginally positively. Thank you, Femi.
Right, you're very welcome. Thanks, John.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. On this Tuesday, June 10th, as we all know, gas prices have hit a new historic high in the United States. They're averaging over $4 a gallon. I think I saw somewhere in 23 states, it's over. Gas prices are over $4 a gallon. And we are going to take a look at prices all over the world.
Let's take Stephen Dubner on a tour, yes.
There we go. On a trip around the world of gas prices. Let's start with cab drivers in London.
So we've gone from 120 straight through now to 130. In some places, it's 135 per litre. So you're talking about £5 a gallon. You're looking at about £30 per day. But you have to live with it. You have to carry on. You have to do what you do. Happy days.
And he's burning diesel. He's burning diesel.
To do the math, though, let's do the math first, just so people are clear, that that's $8.96 per gallon in dollars.
But that is with the exchange rate, just to be fair.
Just to be fair.
Because the pound, to them, the pound is the pound. That's like saying if I bring my car to London and drive, it's $10.
Now let's go to Kiev, Ukraine, where cabbies are using some alternative fuels.
Very expensive to the petrol. It will cost 1 liter, $1.20. But I have a natural gas, and it will cost in half. Yes, 70 cents.
And that's about $4.54 a gallon, just to make that currency
and
exchange.
That's happening all over the world. Cabs, a lot of cab fleets are using natural gas as well as gasoline, as well as diesel.
Stephen, you look like you were going to say something.
Oh, I wasn't, but I'm always happy to.
All right, let's go to Sydney.
The way the petrol's going, it's going to get harder and harder to live. Terrible. It's $120 to fill it up today. It used to be about $50. Now it's about $120 to fill it up. It only lasts about 3 days, and you've got to fill it up again. So it's a big pain. For an average salary earner who earns about $500 a week, plus their mortgage, and $100 every 3 or 4 days, it's a big pain, believe me.
A big pain. In fact, he says it's getting harder and harder to live. But there is one place where cab drivers are not feeling the pain of high gas prices. Let's go to Venezuela.
I am a taxi driver in Caracas. The price of the gasoline is very cheap. It's going to cost about 3 cents per liter. Yeah, I can fill this car with a couple of dollars easily. And this car is have the tank very big.
He said a very big tank, and he's paying 11 to 12 cents per gallon.
The problem there, though, is that you're in Caracas.
Venezuela. Yeah, it's kind of the reason we've had cheap corn for 30 years here. Subsidies are great if you're buying the thing that is That's subsidized right. by the government. Absolutely.
So what is the political – what happens when you subsidize fuel like that in terms of the government? They're making a big bet.
They're making a big bet. It's really interesting. I mean, if you want to talk about greenhouse gas emissions, which we've been talking about a little bit earlier here with the locavore stuff, high gas prices are a godsend. Okay, if you want to talk about greenhouse gas emissions. Why? Is because driving is the human activity that produces the most what we call negative externalities of everything. Pollution, carbon emissions, congestion, traffic accidents, etc. There's almost nothing good about driving except getting where you're going.
So higher prices reduces that.
An economist would say so. Subsidies yeah. absolutely yeah. increase it. One of the reasons we're so dependent on corn syrup as part of our diet here is because we subsidized corn so much and had so much of it.
And so we've encouraged people to use a lot of it. Stephen Dubner, author of Freakonomics and the blog Freakonomics on
AroundTheWorld.com.
Thank you.
Thanks for the
Dubner.
Trip.
You're welcome.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
John from Brooklyn. In 1962, Nobel laureate economist Amartya Sen first articulated the notion that has been confirmed by dozens of studies that there is an inverse relationship between the size of farms and the amount of crops they produce. In other words, small farms produce a larger yield.
Take that, Stephen Dubner. That was someone weighing in on our Spinbox 8778. My take, and the question is, what do you think about localvores, buying locally and producing agriculture locally? From Wade via email, I won't eat fresh tomatoes till they hit the farmer's market. Eating tomatoes shipped from afar is a total waste of money since they have zero flavor, terrible texture, and who cares about tomatoes when I can get asparagus, kale, snap peas, or shell peas at my local farmer's market. So that's that question, but history was made yesterday. See if you can recognize this fellow here. The Roadrunner, of course. But the Roadrunner is actually a computer. IBM yesterday made computer history with a machine that crossed the petaflop threshold. That's a quadrillion individual floating point operations that took place in a second. It's a staggeringly important milestone. And Jack Dongara, a professor of computer science at the University of Tennessee, is here to explain it to us. Jack, thanks for being with us.
Well, good morning.
Explain the importance of this threshold, 1,000 quadrillion floating point operations in a second. What does it mean you can do with this computer?
Well, it's the fastest computer that is in existence today. And just to put it in comparison, it's twice as fast as the one that was the fastest just a few days ago.
Did that? Is that one like been thrown out? in the dumpster somewhere?
Not exactly. No, yeah. that's a fairly expensive piece of equipment that'll be used for a number of years. But it is number two today, and this machine at one petaflop, as you say, is number one.
Well, glad to hear it, Jack. Now, this machine was made by stringing together a lot of fairly rudimentary technology chips. You know, chips that you can actually find in appliances you can buy at Best Buy. But putting them in an architecture that's massively parallel and enables the computer to do all kinds of large-scale things. Can you explain exactly how this computer was built?
Sure. There's if you think about processors, like the processors in your computer, there's 122,000 of these processors in this box, let's say. The box is the size of very large room, about 5,000 square feet. And the processors are very complicated in the sense that they come from a hybrid design. So they're commodity processors like the processors you would find in your own PC, and they use a processor that's actually derived from the Sony PlayStation's processor. That is, the computer that is in the Sony PlayStation has been modified slightly and is used. They have many of these processors in them. So there's an interesting...
Well, that's what the engineers are saying anyway. Yeah, we modified it, so it's not a real PlayStation, right? It's serious work, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Jack, let me just jump in here for 1 second. For us lay people who aren't necessarily as familiar with all of the mechanisms and so on and so forth, what does this really mean when you're saying that this is more powerful than the most powerful computer 2 days ago? What does that mean to me, someone who just uses a laptop for internet and data processing?
Right. So for the average person, it doesn't mean very much, except that the technology and the all the knowledge that went into building this machine will eventually trickle down to the home consumer in some sense. And that may take a number of years.
But at the research level, this machine is great at doing large-scale simulations of, like, nuclear explosions, I think I read.
Absolutely. We couldn't this machine will give us a much better window into what has happened or what will happen in certain situations. Today we do numerical simulations to help us understand our world around us, and this is the most powerful device. Think of it sort of like the Hubble telescope for computers.
That's a great analogy, Jack, and pretty totally like awesome graphics, right?
Incredible.
Yes. Awesome. Yeah, yes. Okay, Jack Dungara, thank you very much. He's a professor of computer science at the University of Tennessee, talking about the threshold that was passed yesterday, the one petaflop threshold. I know where I was.
It sounds so exciting, but I'm just not sure what to be excited about.
It means that we can simulate nuclear explosions without having to detonate any bombs, which I think makes me feel a little better.
Although,
and also,
you know,
climate change.
The early space exploration, when we first started sending people into space, I was talking with someone who was at NASA at the time. He said the computing power then would fit into a Palm Pilot now. Right?
Yeah.
Oh. So we are capable of great things without. It'll be interesting to see what we're capable with.
We're on a roll here involving innovation. And here's a question for you both. What do you do if you're an unsigned rock band and you have a new single out soon and you need to produce a music video, but you don't have any money to do it?
You find a banker, a rich guy, a supermodel.
Sing at NYU film school?
If you live in England, all you really have to do is find somebody to film it for free, right, and then get your hands on that video. The band, the Get Out Clause, did exactly that. They performed their new song, Paper, in front of a...
surveillance cameras?
CCTV security cameras in their home city of Manchester, England, and they made a music video. And joining us now is the singer, Jamie Hancock. We also have the drummer, James Thompson, and we have the guitarist, Tony Churnside. Hello, gentlemen. How did that work out for you, CCTV video for a music video?
Hi there, it's James here. I think it worked out really well. Obviously, it's gained us lots of publicity, which is exactly what we were looking for.
I don't understand what you did. So you went around to security cameras and performed in front of them and edited it together?
Pretty much, yeah.
How did you do that?
Well, we were I don't know how things are over there, but over here there are a lot of CCTV cameras. I think, was it the average number of times you get filmed in an urban environment in a day was
300?
300 times a day.
And I think there's one camera for every 14 people in the UK, one security camera.
Yeah, like that. Yeah, it's an incredible amount of surveillance goes on over here, either directly watched or not.
So you play your song and then you go to the store owner or whoever owns the camera and say, "Hi, I need some of the video."
Pretty much, that's exactly what we did.
and they just give it to you.
Well, there's an information act over here called the Data Protection Act, which basically instructs any company that holds information about you. It tells them they need to release that copies of that information to you.
They have to give it to you.
They have to provide you with copies.
Oh, I love that.
But not everybody did provide it to you, did they?
No. There were a lot of excuses that we were given as to why we couldn't be given the footage.
So it's actually illegal to get in the way of you making your video.
Yes.
I love that. Pretty much.
And here's your song. Brilliant. Here's your song paper. And it really has nothing to do with security, right? Or really anything to do with where you were filming it. It's a song about a man writing a letter to his girlfriend, right?
Yeah, basically. But the idea of the CCTV footage was just too good not to use, so we thought, yeah, let's use it.
Guy, how did you even come up with the idea? You're just sitting around one day and you said, gee, there's these security cameras. I think we'll go perform in front of them.
Yeah, pretty much. We're talking about speed cameras for traffic, I think. But then we got onto CCTV cameras and there's just so many. We thought, why not? You know, you can stand on almost any street in Manchester and get footage back from it.
Now, you guys, your sound is a little sort of Coldplay, if you'll excuse me. Is this just a way of distinguishing yourself, you know, from the kind of generic sort of, you know, Coldplay sound that's out there all over the place? You know, I have to ask you the tough question.
Oh, no, it's fine. A fair few people have described us as that kind of Coldplay, Snow Patrol kind of sound. But we really try to be about writing songs, and that's kind of where we come from.
Do you guys have a record deal?
No, we don't have a record deal. Neither are we looking for one, actually, at the moment. The way kind of the technology is moving at the moment and the way the market's moving at the moment, it's not really necessary to be able to release records online because there's so much online distribution that you don't really need a record label behind you these days.
And your video, it is on YouTube. James Thompson, drummer, Jamie Hancock, singer, and Tony Churnside, guitarist from The Get Out Clause. Listen, you guys, all the best to you.
Thanks very much.
And then the video is all over YouTube. It's actually a very, very big video on you. What do you think of that idea?
I think it's brilliant, but I also think that if you are on the other side of things, what a major pain in the neck. I'd never heard of this law. You have to release security footage. So let's say now I have my Girl Scout troop or any group of people that I want to take out.
Careful.
And have them performing, you know, proselytizing, bandoleering, and all
sounds
of a sudden...
Sounds like a terrible bureaucratic
exactly.
problem, potentially.
No, I own the rights to the security cameras of me in the subway. I'm going to demand that the movie of me on the New York subways be released to me.
And I bet that's a big hit on YouTube.
Well, it will be. If I can just get the footage.
You can get the
Thank you, Stephen Dubner, for being with us all along on this show. He always makes it brighter in here.
He does indeed. Interesting point. They said they don't need, that band does not need a record company.
Yeah, well, have you heard their music?
That's a takeaway.
That's a takeaway.
I like their music, as did your daughter, because she sent you an email after the segment.
So
right
anything,
now.
Any, respond, just like I did there, to anything on the takeaway. Keep your responses coming. 8778-MY-TAKE. Of course, that's Spinvox, or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. If you missed anything, it's all on our podcast.
It is indeed.
Yeah.
Have a good day.
And the name of the band is The Get Out Clause, and that cut was the paper. So if you like it, go to our website.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.